The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting live from our studios in New York City and streaming live over ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or GaryKnoll.com. Today, I'll be joined in studio in just a few minutes by two remarkable individuals. They're both Conversations with Remarkable Minds. We're going to talk about America's war on its own people, how the people can change the direction of the country, with Professor Francis Fox Piven, Professor of Political Science and Sociology at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, as well as Professor Richard Wolff. And Professor Wolff is going to talk about the collapse and faults of capitalism in its American political form, and also the global meltdown and its aftermath. And he is a professor emeritus in economics, University of Massachusetts, and as well as currently teaching international affairs at the New School for Social Research in New York City. Those will be our conversations with the Remarkable Minds. They'll be here after they finish their filming. I've been filming all morning for our Poverty Inc. documentary. Every day this week I am filming. And then hopefully next week at University of Berkeley, and that film, as well as Greed Street, my take on Wall Street and its history of malfeasance towards Americans, will wrap those two films, and we go into post-production. And also tomorrow I will be filming America's greatest chef, David will be... Boulay will be filmed in his teaching school tomorrow afternoon, and that'll be a lot of fun. I've already filmed him on two occasions. This will be the final filming about his philosophy about cooking and food and vegetarianism, and getting a lot of tips. And we'll need a driver for our crew and myself tomorrow afternoon right after this show. Anybody who'd like to drive us down can also sit in and watch this remarkable individual talk about food. And I'll give you a number that you can call in later if you'd like to do that. Time permitting today, our issue will be America's much-abused moral authority. Comments from Morris Davis. And he has something to say about this. He was the former chief prosecutor at Guantanamo. And he is saying the United States regularly engages in torture and violations of human rights. So we will ask the question after this, what are your thoughts? Should we, as a nation, when we tell other nations, including Libya, that they should respect the rule of law and human rights, when we are a primary abuser of it? And then from buccaneers to profiteers, on the origins of corporate power. This is a real history lesson that I'll be sharing with those in this audience who care about history. A lot to talk about, so let's get started. First up, always on health and nutrition. The vegan diet can help keep toxins away. This is the latest study on this subject, and it says the following. Sticking to vegetables for 5 days a week can significantly reduce the body's amount of antibiotics and other chemicals, a common problem that we even find when consuming plastics. To come up with the conclusions, researchers in Korea did a study when people stayed at a Buddhist temple for 5 days, during which they ate a vegetarian diet. The researcher analyzed the urine samples before and after the stay and found that levels of chemicals dropped dramatically by the end of the experiment. This was published in Discovery News. Now, quote, a significant correlation was found between food consumption and the urinary levels of several antibiotics and phthalates. Although the exposure to target compounds might be influenced by other behavioral patterns, these results suggest that even short-term changes in diet may significantly decrease inadvertent exposure to these chemicals. Now, in lay language, what this means is that when you drink vegetable juice, eat your vegetables, and have drinks made from vegetable powders, you are detoxifying. You're getting rid of the chemicals in your diet. Also, in these Buddhist temples, they don't use plastic. The average American is consuming minor, tiny amounts of particulate plastic all the time. You drink out of a plastic water bottle, you're getting plastic. You cook with plastic, put it in the microwave, you're going to get plastic. So getting rid of this can be as quick as 1 week of making a substantial reduction in body burden. That's why 1 week vegetable diets are very important. Everybody's been looking at the brain as the cause of Alzheimer's. This study says, hold on a second, why don't you look at the gut and the liver? Let me read this. Quote, a new study has suggested that plaques associated with Alzheimer's disease start in the liver and not in the brain, completely altering scientists' ideas about the disease. The unexpected results could now potentially simplify the nature of Alzheimer's prevention and treatment strategies. Researchers from Scripps Research Institute used a mouse model for Alzheimer's disease to identify genes that influence the amount of amyloid plaque that accumulates in the brain. They found three genes that protected mice from brain amyloid accumulation and deposits. For each gene, lower expression in the liver protected the mouse brain. And then it went on to talk about this. Now, why is this important? Simply this. For decades, those of us in the health field have known that you start all health programs by first cleansing the gut. High-quality fibers like apple pectin and blueberry, which has a blueberry fiber, very soft gel, that cleanses the intestine. Then clean the liver. How do you best clean the liver? By a high alkaline diet and juices. Dark green chlorophyll juices, grape juice, watermelon with lemon and lime juice, cabbage with horseradish juice. These are well known and long observed cleansers of the liver. So when you start cleaning the liver and getting the liver functioning correctly, getting viral loads down, enzyme levels normal, getting good back probiotics into the body, then the whole body is more receptive to health. So that's just showing that one of the reasons I believe that we've had such good success helping people with Alzheimer's is because for the first year, a person has to go through a rigorous liver and blood cleansing, lots of antioxidants, lots of phytonutrients. Now this makes sense as to why their brain is improved. Separately, from Therapeutic Advances in Gastroenterology, the peer-reviewed journal, turmeric fights colon cancer. Tel Aviv University researchers have discovered that turmeric's active ingredient, called curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N, amplifies the therapeutic activity of highly toxic anti-inflammatory drugs used to fight colon cancer when used in high doses. Now, we all know turmeric because it's the bright yellow spice from South Asia belonging to the ginger family and is the main ingredient in curries. And a doctor, Shara La'iri of Tel Aviv University School of Public Health at the Shackler Facility of Medicine and his colleagues found that curcumin can fight cancer when used in combination with popular anti-inflammatory drug. Well, I have found that curcumin by itself, forget the turmeric, go directly to curcumin. I would say 2,000 milligrams a day of curcumin can then help prevent cancer, and that's just one of the things it does. In your bloodstream, curcumin has been shown to help protect the cells. It's a great antioxidant. So take your curcumin, prevent cancer. Many of you, I'm sure, have seen hemp butter, nut butter. It's on the same shelf with your almond butter, cashew butter. You've seen hemp oil right beside olive oil and flaxseed oil. Here's the Good Stuff, Bad Rap from Alicia Ruiz, Chicago Tribune. Quote, hemp, its advocates say, is nature's perfect food source. It has omega-3, omega-6 fatty acids, contains 33% protein, is a good source of vitamin E, and is low in net saturated fat. It's an environmentally friendly crop that grows fast and requires few pesticides. But we can't farm it. Hemp is also a controversial food source because of its relationship to its cousin, marijuana. Hemp seeds can contain trace amino amounts of THC, the psychoactive chemical in marijuana. While it is legal to import, sell, purchase, and consume industrial hemp in the United States, it is illegal to grow it without a permit from the Drug Enforcement Administration, and it is virtually impossible to get such a permit. The policy stems from the Controlled Substance Act of 1970, when all varieties of cannabis were put into a category of scheduled drugs along with heroin. The DEA tried to ban hemp food consumption in 2001, citing its THC concerns. The ban was struck down in court. Recent years have been good to hemp foods, which have gone mainstream, sitting alongside soy and flax in health food stores and appearing in the form of hemp oil, hemp milk, hemp butter, as well as in salad dressings, nutrition bars, bread, cookies, waffles, and frozen desserts. It's also in shampoos, lotions, and soaps. Sales of hemp grocery and body care products are about $37 million. That's not bad, but it's not terrific either. And hemp food products mostly come from Canada. Industrial hemp, which also is imported from China and Europe and used to make fabrics, paper, rope, construction materials, and biodiesels, comes from the same genus and species as marijuana, Cannabis sativa, but represents a different variety. And so the issue is it good for you? The hemp products? Yes. And it's unfortunate that we can't grow it in the United States. This really is regressive food policy, and we should change it. Here's something novel. Seattle business refuses to serve TSA agents. Let me quote this. A nationwide revolt against naked body scanners and invasive groping carried out by predatory thugs goes viral, by Paul Watson, PrisonPlanet.com. Quote, a Seattle cafe has sensationally banned TSA workers from entering its business premises, refusing service as a consequence of the odious reputation the agency has required in the aftermath of a nationwide revolt against invasive pat-down procedures and naked body scanners. As a symbolic protest against enhanced pat-down procedures that involve TSA agents literally touching the genitalia of passengers, including young children, the boss of a cafe near Seattle-Tacoma International Airport has blacklisted TSA workers in retribution for their role in eviscerating the Fourth Amendment and assaulting all notions of decency. Quote, we have posted signs on our doors basically saying that they aren't allowed to come into our business, cafe workers at MC McLawson told Chris Varela, quote, we have the right to refuse service to anyone. My boss flies quite a bit, and he has had an amazing ability to remember faces. If he sees a TSA agent come in, we turn our backs and completely ignore them, and then they leave. Their kind aren't welcome in our establishment. A large majority of our customers, over 90%, agree with our stance and stand by our decision. We even had the police on our side, and they have helped us escort TSA agents out of our cafe. Until TSA agents start treating us with the respect and dignity that we deserve, then things will change for them in the private sector. Oh, and by the way, here's something on TSA. Over the past few years, TSA agents have been caught in numerous acts of criminality and abuse, stealing thousands of dollars of cash and other valuables from airport travelers, repeated assaults of passengers and their own TSA colleagues, drug abuse while on job leading to maniacal bouts of screaming and insane power trips, stealing laptops and other expensive electrical items, sabotaging sensitive screening databases, offensive jokes about planting drugs on travelers, hundreds of cases of forcibly groping travelers, exposing breasts, removing sanitary towels from vaginas, and brazenly targeting attractive women for enhanced screening and sexual abuse. Even abducting and sexually assaulting women, multiple sexual crimes targeting underage minors, downloading thousands of child porn, abusing naked body scanners to sexually harass female colleagues and taunt male colleagues about the size of their penises. Given the nature of that list, and it's barely scratching the surface, it's hardly surprising that businesses across America are starting to blacklist TSA agents and refuse them service. On the flip side, the list also explains why prank callers who contact the TSA about job opportunities while pretending to be sexual perverts, porn addicts, and pedophiles are also treated seriously by TSA staffers. Now, my own thoughts on this are simple. I travel a great deal. I fly a great deal. I refuse to allow the body scanners because my understanding of the science of it is that it can pose a problem to our bodies. But when I see a small child being patted down and their sexual genitalia touched, I'm thinking, this can't be happening. But it is. When we see that a young four-year-old that is paralyzed and has leg braces is told to walk through the scanner without the leg braces and can't do so, and the child is screaming, the parents are frustrated, and yet the TSA is indifferent. When a woman must remove a tampon in the middle of her period to have a look at her vagina, to me this is sexual abuse. Any man or woman that touches the genitalia of a child should be charged as a sexual predator and arrested. The fact that we as a nation have allowed this to happen, for what reason? Here's what it comes down to. The former head of Homeland Security has contracts with the company that makes the scanners. It's all about profiteering from the fear hysteria created by a nation that has lost its balance and common sense and reason when it comes to how to really deal with terrorism and at the same time balance that with our human rights. And finally, from our health nutrition section today, red onions help prevent heart disease. Quote, and this is from Chinese University in Hong Kong, and it says the following. The humble red onion, commonly used in Indian and Mediterranean cuisine, can help prevent heart disease. Researchers found that the red onion helps remove bad cholesterol from the body, which is responsible for heart attacks and strokes. It also retains the body's good cholesterol that in turn helps protect against heart disease. And that's good. Many of you have been trying to hear us over the internet, but we found that we had a problem with the internet at the beginning of the program, and some hackers got in and closed us down. I'm wondering if it wasn't because of our two guests today, because both of my guests are known for standing up to the right-wing propagandists in the Koch brothers and a lot of other people, Professor Francis Fox Piven and Professor Richard Wolff. You never know how dirty tricks occur, but we have not had our services hacked into before, but they were today, just before the show. So those of you who are listening on our terrestrial land-based stations. We're going to take a break and come back in a moment. Excuse me, as soon as my guests are finished being filmed, they'll be in studio, and then I will go ahead and film them, record them additionally in case we don't have adequate time for them, and I'll play that full recording on an upcoming program. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. You can listen and watch over our video stream. It's just our main server has been hacked into by saboteurs. It happens. We just accept it. But thank goodness we have 95% of you are listening over our land-based stations. But you can listen and watch. That stream is fine. Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or GaryNoll.com. Now we're at that part of our program where I share issues. Now, these are issues that are not generally discussed in the mainstream media, but I believe are important. After I share the issues, please feel free to call in and share your point of view. I'd like to hear it. We have a lot of people who have very interesting takes on different issues. This one is about this is from Morris Davis, CommonDreams.org, and I'll quote it. It's short, but I think important. Once upon a time, Americans across the political spectrum were united behind efforts to prevent torture and punish torturers. The United States signed the UN Convention Against Torture in 1988 when President Ronald Reagan was president. A Democratic-controlled Congress ratified it in 1994, and the Convention Against Torture says, quote, "No exceptional circumstances whatsoever may be invoked or justified for torture," unquote. A principle the U.S. endorsed without reservation. So the Convention Against Torture requires nations to enact domestic laws criminalizing torture, and in 1994, a torture statute was added to the U.S. Criminal Code. In lay language, that simply means that no one under any circumstances can torture. If you do, everyone who is responsible, from those giving the orders to those committing the torture, then have broken criminal law and international law. Americans were solidly against torture when they believed that they were beneficiaries of anti-torture laws. But then the September 11, 2001 attacks occurred and created an exceptional circumstance used by some to justify drawing new lines. And Susan Crawford had held key posts in Republican administrations dating back to Reagan. Then in 2007, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates appointed her to head the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In an interview with Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, published a few days before President George Bush left office in 2009, Crawford explained why she dismissed charges against Mohammed al-Qahtani and the so-called 20th hijacker. Quote, "We tortured him. His treatment met the legal definitions of torture." U.S. government officials in other detainee cases reached similar conclusions. Judge James Robinson in the case of Salali found, quote, "ample evidence that he was subjected to extensive and severe mistreatment at Guantanamo." Military Commission Judge Colonel Stephen Henley concluded that Mohammed Jawad endured, quote, "abusive conduct and cruel and inhumane treatment, torture," and that his abuse, quote, "was not simply negligence, but flagrant misbehavior," unquote. Judge Henley suggested those responsible, quote, "face appropriate disciplinary action." None has. In the trial of the East African Embassy bomber, Federal Judge Lewis Kaplan granted a motion to block the testimony of the only witness connecting him to the explosive use. The reason why was that the CIA had used torture. Quote, "The court has not reached this conclusion lightly. It is acutely aware of the perilous nature of the world in which we live, but the Constitution is the rock upon which our nation rests. We must follow it, not only when it's convenient, but when fear and danger beckon it in different directions. To do less would diminish us and undermine the foundation upon which we stand," unquote. In a memo in early 2003, Jack Rives, U.S. Air Force Judge Advocate General at the time, and now Executive Director of American Bar Association, warned senior government officials that, quote, "several of the exceptional interrogations," meaning torture, "amount to the violations of domestic criminal law and the military criminal code, and the interrogators in the chain of command at risk of criminal accusation," unquote. By the way, President Bush and all of his administration ignored the warning. Philip Zelikoff, a State Department attorney in the Bush administration, told Congress, quote, "The U.S. government adopted an unprecedented program of coolly calculated dehumanizing abuse and physical torment to extract information. This was a mistake, perhaps a disastrous one. It was a collective failure in which a number of officials and members of Congress of both parties played a part, endorsing a CIA program of physical coercion," unquote. And finally, in a speech in May 2009, President Barack Obama said, in the wake of 9/11, the U.S. government made some decisions, quote, "based upon fear rather than foresight," and the nation, quote, "went off the course." Now, he rejected the notion of, quote, "brutal methods like waterboarding were necessary to keep Americans safe," and added that such tactics, quote, "undermine the rule of law and alienate us from the world." Then President Obama warned Libyan President Gaddafi last week that the brutality inflicted upon his own citizens was, quote, "outrageous and it was unacceptable," saying that it violates, quote, "international norms and every standard of common decency." He said those responsible, quote, "must be held accountable." He ended his remarks by saying, quote, "the United States will continue to stand up for freedom, stand up for justice, and stand up for the dignity of all people," unquote. The United States cannot stand up for justice and the rule of law when it sits idly on its own record of torture. It diminishes the weight of its own moral authority to influence others around the world when it treats its binding legal obligations as an option it can choose to exercise or ignore. If President Obama is sincere about standing up for fundamental values, then America's actions must live up to its rhetoric. End quote. Morris Davis, U.S. military officer, chief prosecutor for the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay. My final thoughts on this. I believe that if we are to represent anything even remotely coming close to democracy, then we must honor international treaties. We have chosen not to do that for some time. As a result, the President of the United States, George Bush, acknowledged waterboarding. Dick Cheney acknowledged waterboarding. Rumsfeld acknowledged waterboarding. More than 43 government officials under oath acknowledged waterboarding. We have now called that enhanced interrogation. That means by international law, without equivocation, they are all responsible for crimes against humanity. How can we possibly be looked upon with anything representing meaningful, honest dialogue if we are a major perpetrator? And let us not forget, one of the reasons that we gave $1.3 billion a year to Egypt was because countless numbers of individuals were outsourced there by the United States, called Rendition. And this was the first radio program in the United States to talk about rendition, as early as 2003, where they were tortured, some murdered. And that was also true in Jordan and true in other countries as well. So I think it's time that we establish some moral balance in our own country before we lecture the rest of the world on its lack of morality. Those are my thoughts. I'm Gary Noll. Our guest is in studio. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. We are now going to the section of our program that we call Conversations with Remarkable Minds. We will only have one of those remarkable minds. Our other guest, Professor Richard Wolff, is still being filmed, and we will invite him on an upcoming program. Interesting that my guest in studio right now is Professor Frances Fox Piven. She is professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. She served as the president of the American Sociological Association until 2007. And she's had a career committing herself to conditions that better lead us in understanding the true natures of poverty and how we can solve those problems. Her theory of ending social reform, devised with her late husband, Richard Cloward, became known as the Cloward-Piven strategy. And a lifelong social activist and public advocate, she's received many honors and awards. She's also the author of Challenging Authority, How Ordinary People Change America, and The War at Home. Nice to have you with us.
Glad to talk to you, Gary.
I thought you'd find it interesting that out of 22,000 broadcasts, this is the first one that hackers got in just before your broadcast and knocked us off, sabotaged us over the Internet. Isn't
really?
That interesting? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We've never had that. Clearly, and our Internet company just told us it was saboteurs who did it. Never happened before in my whole broadcasting history.
Well, what's your guess about who did it?
I have no idea, but it certainly was Noam Chomsky. But in any case, we still have plenty of people listening over Pacifica stations, over the we're streaming live, so we have a large audience listening. Now, I would like for you, if you would please, to give us your understanding of how we got to where we're at. It is my nature to ask few questions and listen with my audience and to allow this to be more of a classroom on the air. I don't like interrupting people. So here's the overriding premise. We are a nation that is of several different dynamics. We had the dynamic of the old poor that no one paid attention to as a society. Individuals certainly did, but not as a society. They were certainly prevalent where I grew up in Appalachia, down in the dirt farms in Mississippi and Louisiana where I was last week filming them, and in the rust belts. But now we have the new poor, and their numbers are rather astonishing. 17 million American children will go to bed hungry today. 60 Minutes did a piece, its first piece, unfortunately, but thank goodness it did it, and I commend them for doing it. Where on Sunday night, they showed some young people and what it was like to be poor, the new poor, and how they struggled. They never asked a single question about who was responsible for this, or how we could get out of this, or how we got into it. They just simply showed what it's like when you're in it. I thought it was too one-dimensional. They should have done the whole hour on it, but at least they did that, and I commend them for what they did do. We have another segment of our society, the very wealthy, that everyone pays attention to, and underneath them are about 7 million millionaires, whose net worth is $1 million, excluding their homes. They have no problems. They live in the protected green zones, gated communities. Then you have the upper middle income, who have enough savings and retirements and income that they're not really impacted. I almost never see any of that group of people, about 70 million, engaged in social challenges, demonstrations, marches, protests, try to help the 240 million Americans who are now impacted severely. I don't see either the major left or the major right media showing what it's like to be those people, offering programs to help stop home foreclosures, like the President of the United States, by executive order, could stop a moratorium on home foreclosures. I've contacted my own on-staff attorneys, and one's constitutional attorney, and they said, yes, that can be done. Well, why not do it to stop people from being out of their homes? Instead, we don't have the kind of political will at this time or popular support to address the major issues of hunger, dispossession, loss of meaningful living wage, bashing of the unions, diminishment of the quality of life for individuals who are struggling just to survive. And yet this is a massive amount of people, and it's under the radar, hence our consciousness. I went up to Columbia University. I stood outside. I interviewed 100 graduate students coming out of Columbia Grad School in Barnard, and I asked a basic question. Name me the 10 things that come to mind each week that you think about, pay attention to, or watch. Three were shows on television. None had to do with poverty or the suffering, homelessness or hunger, displacement or the environment. Is there something wrong with this scenario? And if there is, the rest of the show, tell us what you see, what got us here, and what we have to do to extricate ourselves.
Well, that's a big charge. But I want to say first that poverty, poor people, have always been considered a kind of marginal problem, not a problem that is either centrally connected to what's going on elsewhere in the society, and not a problem that is the result of what's going on elsewhere in the society. That is true most of the time, that what we do in our discussions, in our way of thinking, and in our politics, is we treat the poor as some kind of special problem. Doesn't have to do with the way our economy functions. Doesn't have to do with the way our politics functions. Instead, we like, for example, to invoke cultural explanations to say, well, there's something wrong with the way those people think, with the way they were brought up, with the communities that they form, which leads them to make themselves poor by not working hard enough or by not thinking ahead or whatever. That's the way we usually think of poverty. The difference, in a way, between the old poor and the new poor is that the old poor have been subject to that kind of denigrating image of who they are and why they are the way they are for a very long time, maybe for most of their lives. And the new poor are now just being exposed to that kind of marginalization and insult, because that's what it is. But you know, I think that the fact that we have, and we always have more poor people in the United States than other rich countries do, and the fact that we have still more now as a result of the policies of the past few decades, worsened by the financial meltdown of 2007 through 9, the fact that we have so many poor has a lot to do with the way the American economy functions. I think that while a lot of propaganda describes the American economy as a free market economy, as something like, you know, a garage sale, things get sold, things get offered, jobs get offered, and the results are more or less to everybody's benefit. Everybody gets the best deal they can in the garage sale. Doesn't function that way at all. The way the American economy functions is much more organized, it's much more predatory, and it involves both organized corporations and government policy. Our economy is very predatory, and one of the ways in which it is aggressive and predatory is that profits are made at the expense of the wages and working conditions of most people. The better the wages, the lower the profits. The better the working conditions, the lower the profits. Well, but how do you get tens and tens of millions of people, more than 100 million people, how do you get them to accept low wages and stagnating wages even while corporate profits are increasing? How do you get them to go along with that? Well, it's a kind of classical problem. It's been a problem for the rich from time immemorial. How do you get the masses of people who do the work, who till the land, who later built the railroads, who built the how do you get them to go along with the fact that they get so little and you get so much? Well, one important way you get them to go along with it is you create a class of degraded, stigmatized people. They become almost a kind of theater. And the lesson of the theater is what happens to people who don't put their shoulder to the wheel, who don't work 50 hours a week, or maybe 60 hours a week. What happens to people in which both parents don't go to work, no matter that the kids have no child care? What happens to people who don't do their utmost to stay afloat? Well, they become the poor. They become this degraded class. And this has been true for hundreds of years in Europe and the United States. And we have different ways of degrading people. At the close of the feudal era, people who were paupers, that means they asked for assistance. That's how you become a pauper. Everybody was poor, but paupers actually asked for help. People who were paupers were put in the stocks. They were branded P for pauper. In some English parishes, they were dragged behind by horses through the town on market day. That's one way of degrading people who have the bad luck to become poor and then the temerity to ask for assistance. But, you know, we are presumably a more humane society. We don't drag people through the town on market day. We don't brand them, but we do brand them. By making the status of being on welfare one of the most humiliated statuses possible in the society. Now, why does that go on? Is it just because we're mean? Well, yeah, we're mean. That's true. We're often mean. But it also goes on because it's a way of disciplining those people who are still working, who are working hard, and who are working for very little, and who are trying to make ends meet. That was true in 16th century England. This display, this dramatic display of the degraded pauper, kept people who were very poor working, working, working. And it's true in the United States as well, even though the way we excoriate them, the way we humiliate them, is less extreme than the branding iron, but still, we do humiliate them. Now, is it ever any different? I think the answer is yes. It sometimes is different. Sometimes there are periods in which the numbers of poor grow and they throw off the huge burden of humiliation, of insult. And somehow, miraculously, they come to think that it isn't their fault. That happened in the Great Depression. Huge numbers of people, as many as 25 million of a population about half the size of today, were unemployed. For quite a while, those unemployed were mainly ashamed, mainly hid their unemployment, mainly pretended to go to work each day so the neighbors wouldn't know. But gradually, and partly as a result of the agitation of lefty activists, but also because people do find a way to rediscover their dignity, after a while, these people began to protest. And the demand went up in rallies throughout the country for bread or wages. Yeah, they wanted to work. They would take wages. But if they didn't get wages, then they should have bread. The media, in particular the New York Times, called these demonstrations riots. And they were riotous. People worked together, you know. The mainstream media calls any large aggregation of people that isn't organized by bureaucrats calls it riotous, after all. So they were rowdy, and they were demanding, and they filled Union Square in New York. 50,000 rallied in Detroit. And these were people who were rediscovering their dignity and their rights, and a glimmer of hope in the fact that they were coming together and they were asserting that it's not us. We're not to blame. They are to blame. The system is to blame. They closed the factories.
It's true.
And it was true.
Absolutely true.
And you know, they won some things. They won some things. They won the first social welfare programs that we had that were national programs in this country. They won Social Security. They won aid to the blind, aid to the disabled, aid to the poor. They won assistance, federal assistance for mortgages. That's what we need today, isn't it?
It is, and yet look who controls the mortgages and how they exploited it against people. If we want to do something good today, I think it has to be very simple. I believe the President of the United States, who has the power, should have an executive order suspending all foreclosures for 3 years. I believe that all of Congress should get together and demand that the banks lower the interest rate to 2%. That's still 200% profit, by the way, because they're getting it at 0.25%. And forgive all late payment fees and penalties, and allow people a chance to rent if they can't afford mortgages. The things we could do are doable, but we don't have the political will, and those in power don't want to forfeit any profits, even though the profits they have are obscene. And that's what concerns me. We've just been joined, Professor Francis Fox Piven, by our other guest who came downstairs. I didn't know we'd have a chance to film him. I'm glad he's in studio here. So let's hear from Professor Richard Wolff. He is Professor Emeritus in Economics at the University of Massachusetts and currently teaching at the Program of International Affairs at New School University in New York City. He's one of the founders of the Association of Economic and Social Analysts, which opposes the theories of economic determinism, which dominates economics today. He is also the author of Capitalism Hits the Fan, and his website is rdwolf.com. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
When you take a look at our problems today, and you hear the Rush Limbaughs, or the Glenn Becks, or Sean Hannitys, or Bill Reilly's, or all the people who are claiming that they are, you know, for the average American, and blaming people who are poor, that you're poor because you're lazy, or you don't want to work, or you want to be on the dole. And then you see the corporate America, who's making astronomical profits, but they're not making it the way that many of us feel they should make it, where you invest in an industry or a business, and you give people a living wage, and you work together to try to strengthen the bonds, where profit isn't your most important incentive, but rather than having a sustainable businesses that helps everyone. And that's become almost passé. Tell us what you see the problems are, the economic problems of the United States, that's led us to where we are, and why you believe that we, both in the media and virtually all the talking heads, are accepting that we are in a great rebounded recovery, that we're coming out of this, and yet many of us do not see that. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I tend to look at this as a systemic problem, that the thing we have to face, which is so hard for us here in the United States, and one of the saddest legacies of the Cold War, is that we have to talk about our economic system. When you check into what bankers do, what hedge fund managers do, and what working people do, is they play, as they like to say, according to the rules. They understand how you go about doing your various jobs, and they perform according to the standards that those jobs have. They try to make money if they're a corporation. They try to make more money if they can if they're a banker. And my sense is here in the United States that we have not only a particular kind of system, our capitalist system, but that we've also developed over the years a set of ideas that function to make this system appear reasonable, appear equitable, appear unavoidable, sort of part of our human nature. I'm reminded as an economics professor of the person who's usually credited with founding our discipline, Adam Smith. And he concocted an idea which really is breathtaking when you think about it. He said that if every person, man, woman, or child, businessman, worker, pursues his or her own self-interest without concern for other people, without concern for the social or the community, if we each pursue our own immediate self-interest all the time, we will nonetheless produce what's best for all of us as a community. We will be led in our self-interest as if by an invisible hand, his famous line. His argument, he was a very religious person, his argument was that we live in a system that God has so organized that each of us pursuing our self-interest will solve all of the community's problems better than any collective effort we might undertake could possibly do. I think that's as powerful a part of our ideology of capitalism today as it was when he penned it in 1776, and it appeared in his book, The Wealth of Nations. Another way of saying this is we have a very individualist ideology. We believe that what happens to people is somehow their own doing. It becomes difficult in times like today when we have suddenly tens of millions of people more unemployed than we did 3 years ago to make the case that suddenly tens of millions of people for individual reasons decided to become unemployed is a tough sell, and it makes life a little harder for Rush Limbaugh and folks like that who want to peddle that old idea. And so for me, I find it sad and depressing, as I assume most of us do, to watch these arguments be recycled over and over again by the folks you mentioned, trying to make it out that people who are poor or unemployed are there by virtue of their own unfortunate decisions and not by virtue of a system that has no place for them, that either assigns them to the rank of the poorly paid or the rank of the unemployed, or, as Professor Piven nicely put it, as the rank of a desperate poor population to kind of terrify those who still have jobs into not questioning the fact that those jobs are becoming less blessed by any benefit alongside, less secure, less with a pension when you get old and you need some help, to accept those conditions for fear of even worse circumstances. I see a system less and less able to function, a capitalism more and more dumping on the mass of people not what it used to deliver. Capitalism used to boast about delivering the goods to people, a rising standard of living, which we had here in the United States for a long time, for at least most people. It's not delivering the goods anymore. It's delivering lots of bads. And you would think we would have by now realized that if the attempts we've made to make capitalism work better didn't work, or if the attempts we made to reform it worked for a while, but then were systematically undone, and that's the history of this country from the last time our capitalism collapsed in the 1930s. We impose all kinds of reforms. Professor Piven mentioned them. Unemployment insurance, Social Security,
Glass-Steagall Act.
Glass-Steagall Act to control banking. But if you look at them, every single one of them has either been evaded, weakened, or obliterated in the period since that time. Very little is left, and the forces that got rid of them are trying to get rid of those few that remain. If you see a system that is delivering the bads, resists reform, or when reforms actually happen, undoes them, then it's time to take the adult, mature step and ask and answer the question, can we do better than capitalism as a system? We should have been debating that for 30 or 40 years. It's a common debate in many other countries with which we are allied, in Europe, for example. What's the matter with us in this country? We ought to be asking that question. If the system doesn't work, then we ought to ask questions about the system.
But you're not having that dialogue in the American media.
No, we don't. We can't ask the question. It's the irony of ironies. To pose the question is to be pilloried as somehow anti-American or anti the status quo.
Now then you become a socialist,
or
a communist,
or a Marxist, or all those things.
They lump them anarchists. They lump them all
terrorist,
together.
It's all synonyms in a kind of terror, in a kind of hysteria. But you know, those things can pass if we face the problems we have. We have an economic system now that is diminishing the standard of living for most Americans and doing it systematically. Not just leading up to this crisis, but the crisis itself has become a mechanism to further that process. We are polarizing the United States into extremes of wealth and poverty. 40 years ago, we were less unequal as a society than our allies in Europe. We are now more unequal than they are because of the rich having become relatively richer. This is a continuing situation that breeds resentment, anger, difficulty, tension. You can see in Wisconsin the notion of labor peace, the notion that both sides are aware in their language that something is disintegrating that was a modus vivendi before. And set aside how successful a modus vivendi it was before, but that awareness of the fraying of the social fabric, of the disintegration, of the remark of the governor of Wisconsin that he's going to call the National Guard in the event people object to what he's doing, these are signs of a society that desperately needs to ask itself about its own system.
Should we not also, I appreciate that answer, thank you, should we not also ask the 100,000 strong who were protesting for collective bargaining rights, which I fully support. Also, why don't you take your 100,000 strong, join hands and circle houses of your neighbors to prevent them from being foreclosed, saying, if you come to foreclose my neighbor's house, you must first arrest all 100,000 of us. And where would you put us? Should we not also say we 100,000 will seek the food that will fill the bellies of 17 million? Should we not also take this single microcosm of that germ of a new mind and consciousness and expand it to the larger needs of so many other people who are not just in Wisconsin and not just school teachers and not just engaged in collective bargaining? Can we not change this into more of a Gaia?
Well, absolutely we should do that, and we may. We may. I see signs that that may indeed happen, that Wisconsin was a kind of beginning. I noticed, for example, how quickly the protests in Wisconsin were echoed in other state capitals around the country, where public sector workers are also threatened with wage and benefit cutbacks that are justified by state fiscal crises. But I also think that some of the groups that are involved in the Wisconsin protest, like SEIU, for example, are planning to link those labor protests to action on foreclosure and other community issues, because that's what is important about this period in American society. It is not only the public sector, both services and workers, that are under the gun. It is also American homeowners that are under the gun. It is consumer debtors that are under the gun. It's students who have accumulated such huge debts. Because why? Because we keep raising tuition and raising student fees. And now they become part of the debtor class in American society. It is the unemployed. It's poor people whose services, which were pretty meager to begin with, whose services are now being cut in the name of fiscal probity. Ridiculous argument. These poor people are also part of this same battle. And we've got to enlarge that battle so that people see the links between their different issues and see also the way in which the opportunities for protest that a group of people whose homes are being foreclosed on, they have an opportunity for protest, perhaps by not moving out of their homes. Public sector workers have the kind of opportunity that was indicated by the Madison action. Students who are in debt over their heads have other opportunities. I think we have to begin to see the links between these different issues and see how they all are rooted in the corporate and government, a government that is under the heel of corporations, how they are rooted in those policies. so that we are on the same side, and it's the other side in the corporate class.
Social issue linking, connecting the links. Thank you very much. Final closing comments for you, Professor Wolf.
Well, I would like to say that we do have examples of people in large numbers getting together to fight against the very issues that the folks in Wisconsin were struggling with. We are, as a nation, rather late in the process. Let me remind folks, during the summer months, the spring and summer and into the autumn of 2010, last year, nearly a dozen countries in Europe had millions of people participating in major actions to stop or reverse the kinds of cutbacks of public employees and cutbacks of public services that we're beginning to contend with, if you like, here in the United States. Places like France and Italy and Spain had general strikes where everybody goes out, where all the unions, together with their socialist and communist and other green parties and so on, were mobilized. They had the institutions to bring different communities together, to do that social networking that we talk so much about in the United States. We haven't been able to do that, and I think one of the reasons is that we didn't have in place the kinds of organizations with a long history who know how to work together, who know each other, and can coordinate their activities to produce mass actions. And I think it points to a lesson, which is we need to rebuild or to build anew the kinds of organizations, whether it be in the labor movement or in the community of poor people or of consumers or whatever it is, and I don't know the forms it will take, and each country develops those itself anyway, but we need organization in order to translate the way people feel into the visible actions that others can see who already agree with these perspectives but always feel isolated and alone because they don't see the expression. We complain about the media, but if we had the organization to move people in massive ways, even these media would have to slowly acknowledge, as they did in Wisconsin, with all our criticisms of them, at least people knew, because so many people were able to be mobilized. And there it was again, community groups, the trade unions, and so on, that got that process together. But if I had to point to anything, I think it's the need to take the struggle here in the United States the next level and rebuild the organizations that have atrophied in this country and that are the difference between how we've been able to respond and the Europeans who held on to those organizations better than we did.
I appreciate both of your comments. My final comments, I wish that both the left and the right media would invite progressive-minded people to come on and share points of view that are virtually they have no voice at all. You see the same talking head, Eugene Robinson, same people on Rachel Maddow. You don't see the diversity of thoughts that we have. For example, I would love an opportunity to talk with, Sean Hannity. And I believe in being polite, but when he says socialism, we get rid of these socialists, I would say, okay. Do you believe that if your house burns down that you should have a fire department come? Or do you believe that your house should burn because you haven't paid for private contracting? Do you believe if there's a threat, you call the police, you have to, first the police would say, do you have insurance? You say, private insurance? No. Do you believe there should be no public education? Do you believe there should be no Coast Guard? Do you believe there should be no National Guard to help you in case there's a hurricane or something, or national disaster? These are part of the social contract that we've all benefited from, including going to a public school, Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly. So when they were engaged in benefiting from those social programs that helped all people, they were supportive of it. Now they mock it. And if you're really against socialism, fine, let's say you're against socialism, Rush Limbaugh, you have a right to be, then please do not be hypocritical. I would like to bring to your attention that you have no problem being against socialism for the poor, but you have a big problem being against socialism for, let's say, for the pharmaceutical industry, the health insurance industry, big oil, nuclear, gas, and how about big agri, and the subsidies go to the big agribusiness, ConAg. If you take those subsidies, it's over $2 trillion a year. I've done the math on it. I'll be happy to share how much the military-industrial complex gets, $1.3 trillion, a total on-and-off-book expenditures. How much do we really need to have a viable defense? About $200 billion. Okay, then be against $1.1 trillion. In a very short time, you balance the budget. You don't have to cut any social programs those in need, but you're not willing to do that. So the question is, are you really against socialism? And call everyone who advocates helping the poor, including myself and others who are progressives, as being wrong? Or are you just being hypocritical? At least honor your thoughts completely and stand up and be against these corporate entities. Be against, you say you're laissez-faire, the government should stay out of business. Fine, let's agree with you 100%. That means not a nickel to Goldman Sachs and Bank America, the 20 leading banks. Ah, well, then that's a different story. Oh, support them, but don't support the poor homeowner who can't afford the mortgage. At what point do we open up the dialogue and debate to allow those of us who have some experience and thoughts in? There are about probably 300,000 or 400,000 of us in the United States. You never see us in these debates. That's unfortunate. And I believe until we have a chance to be in there debating, then we can't get other people to realize there are organizations and foundations and individual groups that could do something positive on their side. Those are my thoughts. I want to thank my guest, Professor Francis Fox Piven, and Professor Richard Wolff, for joining us today. I'm sorry for those of you who could not hear us over the Internet. Keep in mind that this is the first program in my history of 34 years on the air every day that was hacked in and sabotaged. Wonder why? First time today, this show. But for all of you who've had a chance to listen and watch and to our stream, this program will be posted. I thank you all and have a wonderful day.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.